America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Dubrovnik, Croatia, a part of the former Yugoslavia. In fact, we were just walking around in the old city of Dubrovnik. They've got a poster on the wall showing all the various buildings that were bombed and blown up, and pretty amazing. Broadcasting from the Praxis Peace Conference. Where there's a whole bunch of us. In fact, a few folks are going to be dropping by. David Corton and Francis Morlapay, possibly Tom Hayden. And right now in the studio with me, we're broadcasting from the studios of Radio Dubrovnik, Radio Croatia. And very grateful to Zlatko for getting us on the air and having everything working here. Sitting here in the studio with me, Swami Beyondananda, also known as Stephen Berriman. Hey, Steve.
Well, how you doing? It's amazing to be here and be there at the same time.
We're everywhere. Yeah. We're everywhere. Steve is sort of a co-host of the conference. You've been introducing folks and as well as doing your Swami. What would you call it?
You could call it shtick. You can call it.
I didn't know if that was an insult or not.
No, it's okay. I take insults very well. It's shtick. It's comedy. It's cosmic comedy. It's uncommentary, sort of like your uncommentary.
There you go. And a lot of interesting things going on. I'm curious about your thoughts on George Bush and Vladimir Putin. I'm assuming you've been following this in the news. You know what I'm talking about?
No, in fact, we've been in Europe. We've been news free for about a week.
Oh, you have.
Let me fill you in.
Let me fill you in.
Yeah.
Bush, of course, starts out by going, "Well, we don't think that Russia is becoming very democratic, and we're all worried about that. And we're going to put missiles in Czechoslovakia, by the way, and point them at wherever we happen to point them." You know, and Putin says, "You're not putting missiles in my backyard."
You know, you're not putting them here.
So Putin is basically taking the position that John Kennedy took during the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, what, you're going to put missiles 100 miles from my back door? And Bush is going, it's going to be fine. We're buddies.
Amazing. Just amazing. Well, you know, there's kind of a dysfunction at the junction going on right now.
Yeah.
We're getting to see that play out.
And what Bush, I think, doesn't realize is that Vladimir Putin is a very serious guy, a professional killer. A man who actually brags about the fact that he can and has killed people with his bare hands. He's a martial arts expert, former head of the KGB. I mean, and George thinks he's just another frat boy.
Yeah, exactly. Mano a mano with Putin. It would be very interesting.
Yeah, it's watching. What's particularly interesting is watching the news here. In the hotel, watching BBC and CNN International, and CNN International is so completely different than any other form of CNN that you ever see. It's actual news.
Well, you know, the joke is, and it's not really a joke, is that the difference between America now and Soviet Union during the era of the Soviet Union was that people in Russia knew that Pravda wasn't telling them the truth.
Yeah. Yeah,
and big difference.
In fact, there's an old joke. Pravda means news, and Izvestia means truth, or else it's the other way around.
Yeah,
I forget which. Those are the two main news sources. And the saying used to be, "There's no Pravda in Izvestia, and no Izvestia in Pravda."
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, there it goes, and on it continues. So anyhow, here we are. We're broadcasting live from Dubrovnik, Croatia. We are having problem. I don't know if it's the right word, but we're not connected to the internet. So our normal ability to drop into the chat room and say hi. Sue Nethercott is here with us, who runs our chat room. She's not able to get in. I'm not able to get in. Our ability to connect with the software in New York that allows us to put callers on the air is not working. But we can still put folks on the air. We're just going to have to do it through New York. And Alex and Lauren and excuse me, Chris and Lauren in New York will be telling us, you know, who's where and what, probably during the breaks and things like that. So the show today is going to be a little more on the fly than normal.
And, you know, it's great that you yourself are a multinational right now.
Yeah? How's that?
Well, you're here in Dubrovnik. You got New York. you have normally have somebody in England who's doing the chat room.
Yeah, although she's here. Yeah. And Louise is here with me too, and we're having a fine old time. It's fascinating. And the other news of the day. There is an article over on the Daily Kos, and there's a link to it off the Think Progress, the Center for American Progress's blog, is the discovery of Karl Rove's playbook. I thought this was really fascinating, that going back some 20 years or so ago, there was this plan to politicize the federal government during the Nixon administration, and to basically take the civil service apparatus and turn it into a party apparatus for the Republican Party. And it was never successfully executed. And it's what Karl Rove has been doing, and blow by blow. And it's really, really quite startling. Next week when we get back into the States and I have access to all the documents and everything, I want to share with you all more of the detail of it, because I think this is, frankly, I think this is one of the biggest and most startling stories that we have come across this month, and something that's really worthy of getting into some more detail about. So, the conference here, and Steve, your role in the conference, your thoughts on the conference. Last night we heard from a historian, a local guy. He's actually educated in the United States, mm-hmm. MA and PhD from Columbia, as I recall, or Princeton or something like that.
And he teaches at Yale, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
He's in the parliament here, and he commutes to teach at Yale.
Interesting. A member of the Croatian parliament.
Yeah.
And he was talking, he started with the history in the 12th century up through today. But this whole concept of, one of the things I thought was most interesting was one of the questions that was asked of him was, how is the transition from communism to capitalism going here? And because prior to 1991 or 1990, prior to the dissolution of Yugoslavia, the five or six states here that made up Yugoslavia, that now are independent states, were operating in this kind of old Marxist fashion where they had a variation of it here that Tito imposed in the 1950s that was different than most of the other Soviet states. Where they had what they called public property. In addition to state property and private property, there was this third category of public property, which in theory sounded very nice, but in practice didn't work particularly well. And somebody asked him, how did the transition from a state-run economy, a demand economy, state-run economy, the state owning the means of production and supply and distribution, to a more laissez-faire capitalist economy happen? How did it work out? And he said it was very poorly done, actually. He said the only state of all the former Soviet states that did it more poorly was Russia. And the reason why was because in many of the countries, what they did was they took all the state enterprises and they said, okay, what's the value of all these state enterprises? Let's say it's $1 billion. And let's say there's 100 million people. So that's $10 per person. So everybody gets a coupon worth $10. Gets 50 coupons worth $10 or whatever the divisor is. And in other words, everybody gets their share of what the state owns, and they can sell it, they can convert it into stock, they can use it to buy private land, they can do whatever. But basically the state becomes the people's. Whereas in Croatia and in Russia, it was handled more in a quick auction fashion where good buddies of the political structure were able to go to the banks, which were run by the local good buddies of the political structure, and borrow money that didn't exist. In other words, just borrow against assets that they didn't have in order to buy the assets from the state that they could then sell to multinational corporations or to other good buddies of theirs and then pay back the loans. And so you ended up with an oligarchy.
Well, it sounds like Texas after the SNL scandal.
Yeah, actually.
I lived in Texas right around that time, and if you were an insider, you got property at a steal that you could turn around at a huge profit, sort of like some people around 1929.
Yeah.
Those who actually made out around
1929. Yeah, Joe Kennedy. Gloria Swanson used to tell me stories about Joe Kennedy, who she ultimately, rather disliked strongly, shall we say.
Yeah.
But a number of people made out very well during the Great Depression, and so anyhow, it's interesting to see how how these transitions occur and how things are being played out, and the hope for a more democratic and egalitarian society. And it seems to be moving in that direction here. Anyhow, it's the Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. We're broadcasting live today from Dubrovnik, Croatia, at the Praxis Peace Conference. And we'll be having a few people drop by. We'll also be taking your phone calls at 866-303-2270. And, of course, you can drop into our chat room at airamerica.com or tomhartman.com. 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. We're broadcasting live from Dubrovnik, Croatia, the Praxis Peace Conference. And Swami Vyanananda, also known as Steve Behrman, with us. Steve, you had some observations you wanted to share.
Yeah, well, one of the things we've been talking about at the conference, of course, is how culture affects politics. And it seems to me that we are now in a culture of division and separation, which the powers that be in power seem to enjoy, because if we can be polarized into the red tribe and the blue tribe, then it keeps us from communicating with one another, and we also don't really know what's true. I call it privatized truth, and we were talking about Karl Rove earlier, and it seems that the interest of those folks is to really make sure that people don't know what's true. So when you don't know what's true, then anything could be true, or nothing could be true, and so everything is in question. And so when there are people who do have integrity, and they're in politics, which is not a contradiction in terms necessarily, people tend to just expect they're going to be corrupt, they're going to be cynical about that, and so when there's actually real goodness, it's hard for us to discern that.
And therefore,
we are basically kept in the dark, and we don't get to trust our own instincts. We're inundated with so much information, misinformation, distracting information, that we end up, and particularly when there's fear involved, one of the speakers at the conference was talking about what happens when we are given fearful messages, and we go out of our forebrain into our hindbrain, into our fight or flight mechanism. And it actually makes us less intelligent.
Yeah. Well, and the whole thing of fear as an instrument of power. I thought it's interesting that people here were commenting about how George Bush has been using fear as an instrument of power back in the United States, and how relatively horrified people in Europe are by that. It's interesting. In fact, Mike in Los Angeles has some thoughts on Vlad Putin and George W. Bush. Hey, Mike, thanks for calling. What's up?
You were talking about in Washington we have a concentration of power in the realm of financial capital of lobbyists. Missile systems in the United States and throughout the world are another illustration of the concentration of power usurping the so-called public interest. And Putin is showing that the president is either dishonest or confessing his total ignorance on national, international security issues and terrorism with his so-called "we need these missiles," because they are impotent to future threats, whether it be from Islamic Jihad or the so-called Iranians handing them over to terrorists. How is all these new missiles going to protect us from that? So, Putin makes an outstanding argument that Bush is just completely egalitarian. He's going to rule by terror.
Yeah, it seems that way, and there has been, yes, we're going to put missiles here, and they might kind of point in the direction of Russia, and we're going to use those missiles to stop guys with box cutters from hijacking our airplanes.
And Russia is right; it's the biggest joke of the year. And the other point is that Bush says that Russia needs more time for capitalism to develop in their country. But what we're seeing in Russia right now is capitalism in its most advanced state with no regulation. That's why there's such a basket case. There's no coordination or anything. It's a rogue system. Not that the Russians are, but their system is.
Yeah, it's laissez-faire capitalism run amok, and it's actually, you know, what scholars of capitalism pretty much have predicted. Mike, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well said. And you're nodding, Steve.
Well, yeah, I mean, it seems that what we've called capitalism has kind of deteriorated into lowest common denominator, so to speak. That, you know, whoever owns, when you combine the power of power and the power of money, which is what's happened in this country, which is why, as you say in your book, Screwed, why there is a diminishing middle class and we're essentially being recolonized.
This is where we need some new terms. I mean, I am really fond of the phrase free enterprise. I think that, you know, we should somehow figure out a way. You know, it's like Karl Marx brought a new lexicon, you know, and others over time have brought a new lexicon, but somehow capitalism seems sacrosanct. Like, you know, you can't attack capitalism. And the fact of the matter is that raw capitalism, naked capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism is ultimately and always has been demonstrated to be a force of plutocracy and aristocracy. And yet at the same time, regulated capitalism works frankly quite well. I mean, it built a reasonably good society in the United States. You look at the European countries, particularly the northern European countries, it's working very, very well in Sweden, for example, in Norway and other Scandinavian countries. And so, but that distinction, it's a really tough one to make. You know, how do you explain the difference between these things to people when you're trying? I've always thought that just, you know, referring to regulated capitalism as free enterprise, which is frankly what Teddy Roosevelt did.
Mm-hmm.
Teddy Roosevelt used to refer to free enterprise all the time. And then his distant cousin Franklin came along and said, free enterprise has become, unfair enterprise, or too free. And which was an interesting, you know, take beyond the take. But so anyhow, it's 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Dubrovnik, Croatia. David Corton, Francis Morla-Pay, Swami Biyananda, Steve Berriman, whole bunch of us here. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Dubrovnik, Croatia. And special thanks to the folks at Radio Dubrovnik and Radio Croatia, who are allowing us to use their studios. And to Chris Lopresto and Lauren Kirshner in New York, who and Gerald and all the folks in New York who are making all this happen and making it work, the connection and everything else. It's amazing technology. In the studio here with me right now, Francis Morla-Pay and David Corton. And first of all, welcome both of you. Great to have you here, Francis.
Thank you, Tom. I'm very happy to be here.
And David?
Tom, again, always a delight to be on my favorite talk show.
Thank you. I think you're going to have to get a little closer to the mic. You have to get, you know, within three or 4 inches of the mics here.
I'll have to hug David here.
There you go. Yeah, we're sharing a microphone, microphones. Let me start out, David, with you. You both of you heard the conversation that I was having with Steve Berriman a moment ago, and during the break you mentioned that this whole idea of regulating economies. I mean, you, David, you're the author of two great books, When Corporations Rule the World, and your newest one, The Great Turning, that really get to the heart of these issues, as do yours, Francis. I want to get to you in just a second on that, but your thoughts.
Yeah, well, one of the most fundamental principles of real market economics, in contrast to the neoliberal theory, mm-hmm. is the fact that to operate efficiently in the public interest, markets have to have rules. Specifically, they need rules to maintain a degree of equity. They need rules to secure the internalization of costs, so you're not just passing your costs off onto to society. And they need rules to prevent monopoly so that you actually have market competition. And, of course, the market ideology of the free market, that very terminology, is to try to cement the idea that there should be no rules on the market, which means no rules for money or for people that have money. And it's a very interesting aspect of democracy, because you've got this constant competition between the idea of a one person, one vote democracy in terms of the political power of the vote versus the issue of $1, one vote democracy, which is really the foundation of plutocracy.
Right. It's not democracy at all.
It's not democracy at all. And that, I think, is one of the things that we need to wake up to, is the fact that that most of the governing systems that we call democracy are in fact designed as plutocracies, and they're about rule by money. So the terms, even the term free enterprise or the free market, these are really political terms that are trying to distract our attention away.
Well, and there's no such thing as a free market. I mean, it's very simple. Markets are created by people. Markets are created by institutions, typically by the institution of government, and they have very specific rules. And those rules very specifically work to the advantage of certain groups. So if when Franklin Roosevelt came along with the New Deal, for example, he said, we're going to change the rules of capitalism in order to save it from itself. I mean, it's imploding. Look at the Republican Great Depression of the late 1929 and early 1930s. And in order to save capitalism from itself, these are the new rules, you know, to paraphrase Bill Maher badly. So,
I mean, one of the ways I think about it is if you take the rules off of the market, have a free market, essentially the same idea that you have, you very quickly create not a market economy, but a set of monopolies, which are non-competitive. They are actually non-market. It's this interesting thing that if you don't have rules on the market, you basically instantly lose the market.
Right. And it's not competitive any longer. It is predatory.
Absolutely predatory.
In that context, I would say that laissez-faire or naked capitalism or raw capitalism or unregulated capitalism is the ultimate predatory tool for the predators among us, and yet at the same time, a regulated form of capitalism like we have in the United States to a certain extent now, and we had to a much greater extent arguably in the 1950s and 60s when the Sherman Antitrust Act was actually being enforced to some extent anyway, and on, reduces the predation and increases the competition, and thus, you know, the rhetoric of competition being a good thing actually becomes meaningful.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, competition is absolutely essential to the to an efficient market economy. But the basic idea that Adam Smith articulated was much more like a farmer's market kind of competition, where the farmers get together and people trade in a market that is competitive and works fairly.
It was your book, When Corporations Rule the World, where I first encountered a reinterpretation of Adam Smith that caused me to go back and, you know, in school I had read pieces of Wealth of Nations. I'd never actually sat down and read the book. It's pretty dense.
But I
went back and I sat down and I read it, and give your, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, it's interesting. Clearly, Adam Smith's view of the market is a market of very small players. Mm-hmm. And one of the extraordinary things, I mean, the people who really understand Adam Smith note that he really wrote the Wealth of Nations almost as a tirade against corporate monopolies of the time.
Yeah. Specifically, the British East India Company. I mean, this is published in 1776.
One of the major ones, absolutely. Yeah. And the other, if you read it carefully, he's very suspicious of any combination of economic power that goes beyond a one-person firm.
Yeah.
I mean, even the guilds of artisans and so forth, if there was two traders getting together, that was a restraint of the market.
Yeah. And the phrase, the invisible hand of the marketplace, appears only once in the entire book, and it appears in the context of essentially a warning. You know, it's a...
Well, it's... Actually, as I read that one phrase, it's saying that essentially because the investor, the small business person, is investing where he lives, because that's the most convenient where he can keep track of it, he is actually he is contributing to the wealth of his community. But I think it also involves kind of the deeper background of his other book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which is the assumption that he's functioning as a member of the community and observing community values and valuing community interests. So he really creates the business to make his own livelihood, but thereby he is serving community. But it's
right.
in a very
and,
clear set of rules.
Yeah, and that book, the theory of moral sentiment, is something that libertarians and Republicans would like to pretend Adam Smith never wrote.
Yes,
you
right.
know, what, exactly. community? There's no such thing as community. It's you know, it's selfishness rules. Francis Moore LePay, your book's Democracy's Edge, and you have a new one coming out, Getting a Grip. And many people recognize you for your first work many years ago, Diet for a Small Planet, and the work around those kinds of topics. Welcome.
Thank you so much, and thank you, David. I so agree with what you just said. I would just chime in here a bit that part the language challenge and the conflation or the fusing of the idea of capitalism, which I think of as return to capital, returning to wealth, and the market. And actually, I think progressives, as I hear David speaking, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that we are really pro a market, and that a system that is a one-rule market that returns wealth to wealth increases such creates such concentration that an open competitive market is dead. And so I feel so strongly about this, and I just wanted to weigh in a bit more on language, that even the term regulation, unfortunately, I know what we're saying here, but the term, I think, puts fear in the hearts of people because it's been so propagandized.
Right. And what? So, the government's going to control
me? Yes. Actually, I was just on Hardball on Friday where confronting a guy who'd written a book called Mommy, Help, There's a Liberal Under My Bed.
Yes.
And the essence of this was that this lemonade stand, child's lemonade stand, was going to be regulated by the liberals who were going to come in and force them to sell broccoli, right? So the term regulation, I'm trying to...
Catherine DeBrecht wrote that book. I debated her on this program.
Oh, wonderful, yeah. Wonderful. Well, I'm trying to, myself, instead of regulate, talk about standard setting, because I think that the idea, and this is really what we're talking about, the role of government as setting the standards, and I was struck that even Thomas Friedman in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago said that what we need, after he, of course, contradicts himself, because at first he talks about just all we have to do is wed Mother Nature and Father Greed to end the environmental crisis. But then he goes on to talk about setting standards, the government setting standards. And I think really that when we're that's really the spirit in which we're talking, and only as the government sets standards against monopoly, against the externalizing of our of the costs and all of those things, can we have then an open market,
sure.
a competitive market?
Yeah, and we should define the externalization of costs. This is a phrase that those of us on the inside of economics are very familiar with, and a lot of people go, what's that?
It means everything from the incredible health costs now that we're experiencing, because the degradation of our diet, one in every 9 health dollars is now related to obesity, related diseases. It means the pollution in our waterways, then creating a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico the size of Israel, all of these things that we are collectively saddled with.
Right. And the biggest point is that there is an externalizer. In other words, for example, I've seen statistics that a gallon of gasoline, if we actually had the oil companies pay for the cancers caused by the pollution caused by our burning gasoline, that those health care dollars would add $4 a gallon to the cost of a gallon of gas. So there's an external cost of burning gasoline of $4 a gallon. That cost gets externalized by the oil companies. In other words, it's picked up by we the people. It's picked up by taxpayers, by society, rather than the oil companies themselves. So they internalize the profits. You know, and what's his name? The last CEO walks off with a $400 million, golden parachute, and they externalize the expenses. We'll be right back from Dubrovnik, Croatia. Francis Moore LePay and David Corton with us on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. An all-star cast today. A bunch of us speaking here at the Praxis Peace Conference in Dubrovnik, Croatia. And David Corton and Francis Moore LePay with me. And I know we have a number of callers who would like to get into the conversation and get in on some of these issues. First, to George in Hollywood. Hey, George, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I first wanted to mention that think about the idea of this Iraq war. Everybody says freedom is not free, and perhaps responsible is a better word to put in there, responsible enterprise, where you think of others but besides just yourself. But that's all I wanted to say about that, because you guys were just talking about it. I would like to talk about politics, what your previous guest was discussing a little
bit.
Sure,
what Steve Berman was talking about.
Yeah, Berman. He did touch on the possibility that politics in itself is not a dirty word. And in this civilization we have, we are political. That's our nature. And any time anyone tries to squelch that, I think, is being, you know, anti-human. At what point, in your opinion, Tom, is politics a dirty word and should be, you know, shunned?
Yeah. Well, my take on it is that people who try to define politics as a dirty word are the people who want to control the political discourse. And, you know, they try to shut it down. It's a variation on the old political correctness thing. But that, you know, that's my take on it, George. I'm curious if Francis, you or David want to comment on that. I think, Francis, you had some thoughts on it.
I do.
George,
thanks
for the call.
First of all, we have no choice. Not acting, not engaging does not mean that we have no power. Our absence gives power to someone else. And so really the only choice we have is whether how we engage or how we have effect, because, as I say, our silence is also effective in a way we may not wish. I've been looking at the effect of the clean elections practice in both the state of Maine and Arizona. And in Maine, for example, I just encountered a woman who had been a single mom waitress who is now a legislator in Maine, and part of the effort there that has passed a really revolutionary, I think, law that's changed the logic of the economy, whereby corporations who produce electronic equipment have to take responsibility, responsible enterprise, for the recovery and reuse of that. And so here is an approach that actually allows regular folks, in this case a waitress, to become a representative of the people.
This is the voter-owned elections, the whole idea of public financing of political elections.
Yes, exactly.
As is done in Maine and Arizona and in some communities, in where I live, Portland, Oregon, for example.
Yes,
same thing.
In some non-state areas, yes.
Yeah. Excellent point. Gene in Napa, California. Hey, Gene, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. You're having such a great conversation. You just mentioned politics, and I get upset because politics are not innately corrupt. Corruption is what corrupt individuals choose to bring to politics, and I think that this is what happens with our use of words. We apply attitudes and interpretations over their actual definitions, and that's what we have to get straight. We have to start using words, you know, from their direct definition. And that's why I appreciate so much this discussion. What I called about was the suggestion that we replace the word regulation with the word standards and standardization. And I don't think that term would set us up safely with the right. They would just interpret that as mediocrity and middle-of-the-road goals. So I don't think standardization is a good replacement. So I'll get off and listen to your discussion. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jean. Francis, that was your phrase.
Exactly. I wasn't using the word standardization, and I agree. Certainly a hardcore ideologue is going to reject anything that I say, probably. But I think to reach more Americans, I think the word regulation has that kind of frightening idea that somebody's going to put you in a straitjacket, whereas I think my hunch is that more of us understand the need to set standards, and we do it all the time in our homes and our workplaces. And it is, I think, a very uplifting notion that we have a standard in terms of education or how we raise our children. And
the quality of our food.
The cleanliness of our... So I'm not saying that we never use the word regulation, but I find that when I speak that there's more of a resonance with people when they talk about... For example, I often use wonderful story from Brazil, where a very large city, the fourth largest city in Brazil, cut infant death rate by 56% in 10 years. And they did this by declaring food a right of citizenship and then setting certain they brought the community together, so government played the role of convener, and then set certain standards for what food sellers who were taking advantage of certain plots of very cheap land in the city selling fresh produce to poor people, but they had to set the standard price at a low enough cost that poor people could buy it, and it worked.
Hmm. This is where I think that, for example, in Oregon, we tried to, unsuccessfully, but tried to amend the Constitution to say that health care is a right. And, you know, that's the standard notion in virtually every other industrialized country is that health care is a right. And it's and that lack of believing or of explicitly stating that health care is a right, for example, in the United States, is one of the big problems that we've had so far. David, you wanted to weigh in on this.
Yeah, I think the term standards is fine. I don't have any trouble, though, with the use of the word rules.
Yeah.
I mean, in every other aspect of society, we accept the need for rules. We have rules. You'll not kill your neighbor. You'll not steal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that
maybe we should call them the commandments.
Yeah.
The new commandments of capitalism.
Yeah, I mean, corporations shouldn't kill. They shouldn't be have rules so they don't put out poisonous products. They don't put toxics into the environment. They don't steal by misrepresenting their products, and they don't externalize their costs by underpaying workers. I mean,
yeah.
You know, if you're going to get somebody's labor, you should be paying them a living wage that allows them to support themselves.
Amen. Amen. We will continue this conversation with David Corton, Francis Moore LePay, Steve Berriman, and others from the Praxis Peace Conference. And
the Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Dubrovnik, Croatia, the former Yugoslavia in Europe. It's amazing, the technology. Francis Moore LePay here with me, David Corton, Swami Beyond Ananda, also known as Steve Berriman, and occasionally channeling Bullwinkle.
That's certainly true.
Indeed. Great to have all you with us. Just a quick summary of some of the news events of the day. I just want to go over, and they can be grist for the mill of commentary, and we'll also be taking calls, your calls, throughout the next couple of hours. Our number, 866-303-2270, toll-free across the United States. And actually, I think these days people from outside the United States can call 800 numbers in the United States. I remember back when you couldn't do that, but typically you can these days. Vice President Cheney told the Justice Department, this was in the War and Peace blog today, interestingly enough, Vice President Cheney told Justice Department officials that he disagreed with their objections to a secret surveillance program. Now, he disagreed with their objections. In other words, he's all in favor of spying on you and me. Oh, what a great guy we've got as a vice president. It was, Zlatko here, helping us put this thing together with Radio Dubrovnik. He and I were making jokes earlier about, he said, in the United States, and I don't know if you have a mic there, Zlatko, you can turn on or not, but apparently not. He made a joke about in the United States, you know, as you're using your internet connection, is somebody monitoring? And I said, I don't think so. And he said, oh. Yeah, but it's true. It's, you know, so Dick Cheney definitely monitoring our internet and our phone calls and everything else. And here he is saying back in 2004 when James Comey, the guy who rushed to the bedside of the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, to stop Andy Card and Gonzo, our esteemed Attorney General, who was then the official lawyer to Bush, from trying to get the spy program renewed. That Cheney was opposed to this. So you know, this all started with a phone call from Bush, and now we're discovering Cheney's involved too. I mean, this is truly, truly bizarre stuff. Senator Ted Stevens, the esteemed and some would argue corrupt Republican from the great state of Alaska, has been asked by the FBI to preserve his records as part of a widening investigation. That's, you know, something worthy of note. That from the Washington Post. Los Angeles residents, they're having We have no problem with global warming. It's so hot we got no rain. So L.A. residents are asked not to put trash in their toilets. Don't water their lawns. Try to cut your water by 10%. The worst, the driest year since they started keeping track 130 years ago. So it might be the driest year in 1,000 years. Nobody knows. But certainly the driest year in 130 years. The Kuwaiti company that's building our embassy in Baghdad. We call it our embassy. It's building the city. It's 104 acres. It's a massive thing. 21 buildings. It'll be occupied by 5,000 people. Is under investigation for using forced labor, people against their will. And then also Putin. We started out the program in the previous hour talking about Vlad the Impaler Putin and George, who somehow thinks that Vlad is just another frat boy. And this is the New York Times reporting right now. On the front page of the New York Times, the Russian president suggested that instead of building radar defenses in the Czech Republic, and of course Bush wanted it to be more than that, he wanted there to be at least 12 missiles was the number that I heard reported by the BBC last night. He says, instead of doing that, we should use the existing system in the Republic of Azerbaijan, the former Soviet Republic. So this is sort of like Vladimir Putin saying, instead of developing your own defense system, use our defense system. We'll then know what you're looking at and whether or not you're looking at us. And interesting. Well, how is that going to go over with George? See, what this is just classic martial arts. You know, the prime, the key imperative of most martial arts, particularly the more well-developed and sophisticated ones, is you use your opponent's energy that is supposed to be directed at you, ultimately to flip your opponent, as it were. And that's what Putin just did. Bush comes out and says, oh, there's bad guys out there, and they want to, you know, they took down some airplanes with box cutters, and so we need to get missiles in right next door to Russia to be able to stop these guys. Now, setting aside the logic of that, so Putin says, fine, you know, good idea. By the way, we've got some missiles. You can just use ours. And it's just I think it's amazing. It's just amazing. It's you know, our president outmaneuvered. He obviously didn't even see it coming. It's this G8 summit. You know, how badly is he going to humiliate us this time? And then there was a fascinating interview with Bono on BBC, I believe it was. It might have been CNN International. And I'd be really curious to know if any of our listeners in the United States saw this, where he's there along with Bob Geldof, the guy who put together the Live Aid concerts. And he was talking about how at the Glen Eagles G8 meeting, and I think it might have been the G7 at that time, but maybe it was when it first became the G8, which at Glen Eagles, Scotland, this was, what, 2 years ago, 3 years ago? Do any of you remember when it was a couple of years ago. The summary of the summit was, we're going to stop, you know, we're going to help reduce poverty. We're going to take all this money and reduce poverty, and we're going to relieve the debt of many of these nations. And they kind of added those two numbers together. Well, it turned out that it was a trick. It was an accounting trick. What they actually did was they said, okay, we're going to take $5 billion and relieve debt, and we're also going to take $5 billion and reduce poverty. But really what they intended to do was reduce poverty by $5 billion by eliminating the $5 billion in debt. So they were double counting it, and then they never did either one. And so... So in this interview, Bono is going like, you know, he's always wearing these rose-colored glasses. In the middle, it was this incredible, iconic moment. In the middle of the interview, he's going, you know, he's talking about how he was had. You know, he says, I had these guys sign in their own handwriting because this has never been done before. All the heads of state of the world, he said, I had them sign it in their own handwriting that they would do this. And none of them have done it. It's enough to make me take off my rose-colored glasses. And he whips off the glasses. And here's Bono with his naked face. And look at the world the way it really is. Or words to that effect. It was amazing. It was amazing. So anyway, that's just some of the things that are going on in the world. The guest worker provisions in the immigration bill. This may be a deal killer. The immigration bill may be dead. The Republican Party, the right wing of the Republican Party, freaking out. So what did they do? They put this sunset provision in it after 5 years. And this is, I think this is particularly interesting, and I'm interested if any of the three of you here have any thoughts on this. Paul Krugman's column in the New York Times a week or two ago, where he commented that progressives who are in favor of immigration reform that doesn't produce immediate amnesty, unlike, you know, in 86 basically it was boom, you're a citizen. But this bill is, boom, you can be a citizen in 10 or 15 years, or maybe 20 years, or whatever, I mean, minimum of 8 years. His point was that progressives are shooting themselves in the foot if they support this, not just for the normal economic arguments, but because historically the major progressive political force in America has been the dispossessed, the poor, the working poor, those at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. And they have only been able to participate as a progressive force politically when they're allowed to vote. And so basically what this guest worker program is doing is it's saying, yes, you can continue being here. You can continue being the person or the party that would traditionally be the advocate for progressive change, but you can't vote. Thoughts? Anybody want to take a bite at that one?
You can fight in the war, though, right?
Yes. Yeah. Instant citizenship. I thought that was, you know...
It's one of those issues that people really want to have both ways. And, you know, George Bush's position is particular about that because definitely he wants to make sure that there's enough labor.
Cheap labor.
Cheap labor.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There's plenty of labor. I mean, as long as we have ghettos in America, there's labor.
Yeah.
Trust
me. Cheap labor. And at the same time, having to mollify the people in his own party who are anti-immigrant and who also understand that there is a balance.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it is an extraordinarily complicated issue because one of the realities also is as soon as you give the workers rights, they're moving off to find a better job someplace, so you're still not meeting the needs for that really cheap labor.
Yeah, to the extent that you could define it as a need.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, the much deeper issues are looking at what's the nature of the economic system that drives those people across the border here.
Right.
And what about our own sick economy when we've got an economy where we can't afford to pay a living wage to keep the
economy working? Which brings us back to our conversation from the last hour. And we'll continue with that right after this. It's 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Oh, there's stuff happening all over the world. Let me tell you, 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. 1-866-302-2270, our telephone number. Swami Beyondananda, also known as Steve Behrman, also occasionally channeling Bullwinkle in the studio with us. Francis Moore LePay, the author of Democracy's Edge and forthcoming Getting a Grip. And David Corton, his newest book, The Great Turning, before that, When Corporations Rule the World. And Steve Behrman, you also have a book out, the Swami's...
Swami for Precedent, that's Precedent, a seven-step plan to heal the body politic and cure erectile dysfunction.
Ah, fine thing, yeah. A fine thing, indeed. Bill in Queens, New York, welcome, you're on the air. Hey, Bill.
Hey, guys. I have one, I have two quick points. First of all, on competition and free markets. Isn't it the case that whether you have so-called purely free competitive marketplace or regulated competitive marketplace, over time, there are winners and losers. And as the winners, big fish, eat the losers, small fish, a marketplace necessarily tends toward creating monopolies. You can't maintain this equipoise of perfect competition forever. Eventually, there are going to be winners who become the monopolists. That's the first point. The second point is that I've heard you say, Tom, that you feel that government can provide certain kinds of services like medical transportation, but that the production of goods is always better served by a private marketplace. And it seems to me that the open software movement, like Linux, for example, or Mozilla Firefox, shows that if you have people who are motivated by the public good, who want to create effective goods for the common good, that you don't really need a marketplace to create effective products
Yeah, excellent point. Actually, what my argument is that it has to do with what's the commons and what isn't. You know, what do we collectively own and what do we not? And that commons, that notion of the commons is with open source software and things, I think is one of those examples. And yeah, your example of monopoly is spot on. David Courtney had some thoughts on this.
Yeah, I mean, this relates to the nature of the rules. I mean, one of the sets of rules that you have to have for the market to function is a set of rules that maintain a degree of equity. I mean, it's actually fascinating to me that one of the most fundamental principles of an efficient market is that there has to be a reasonable degree of equity in economic power among the various players.
Equity as in equality or equity as in ownership of assets?
Well, it is relative equality in terms of ownership of assets and,
uh-huh.
and income.
Uh-huh.
Because as soon as you get a world that is divided between the very rich and the very poor, the market only responds to the very rich, and so it's no longer allocating resources in any way that is remotely socially efficient. So you need.
It's really no longer a market.
There's no, if it really gets monopolized, it's no longer a market. And so you absolutely have to have strict antitrust enforcement to break up firms that get too large. The same thing with individual wealth. You need a strong progressive tax system as well as an estate tax, which is really kind of like the Jubilee. You know, okay, you can get some rewards during your lifetime, but at the end of your lifetime, you got to redivide the pie and bring equity back into the society.
Yeah.
Now, this is where one of the things that, you know, that we don't really talk about is that the whole financial system, if you take it apart and understand it, it is fundamentally in the business of increasing the wealth gap.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts with a very simple fact that all our policy decision making is all oriented around the idea that we should make our decisions based on what will produce the highest returns to money.
Right. Highest return on investment.
Yeah, but that's the highest return to money, which means the highest return to people who have money.
Yeah.
And so by the very dynamic of the system, as that plays out, you're concentrating economic money, financial power.
Well, and in fact, Bush made this so explicit with his last tax cuts. And Bill, thank you very much for the quality. And good point. I appreciate your making it. Bush made this so explicit with his last tax cuts, where he said that those people who are in their living with money, those people who are in their living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive will never pay an income tax higher than 15%. That's the maximum rate of income tax on dividends and on capital gains, whereas those people who are in their living through the sweat of their brow, through their mind or their muscles, will pay a tax rate that goes into the 30% mm-hmm. range. And it was just so obvious.
That is what happens when you let the rule of gold overrule the golden rule.
Yeah, thank you, Swami.
Yes. Yeah. it's, you know, it all starts with the story that we are conditioned to believe that money is wealth, and the people who are making money are creating wealth.
Mm-hmm.
So then we're supposed to buy into the idea that the people who are enriching the society are the people who are making money.
Right.
Now, in truth, our money...
Which
is Reaganism, exactly. But what none
called,
of...
It's called trickle-down economics. Well, with trickle-down economics, you end up with a nation of peons,
that's
right?
That's right. And people who got peed on, they get tired of being pissed off, they get pissed off. And that's how it
happens. You
and you have uprisings and downfalls and all that.
Yeah, I mean, part of taking this system apart is just simply recognizing that money is not wealth. So when you're making money, you're essentially accumulating accounting chits which give you calls or claims against the real wealth of society. And we've got a money system that is simply geared to making money out of nothing, concentrating it in a few hands so that very rapidly you've got 2% of the global population owning 52% of all the world's assets, and it's accelerating.
And it's a mess. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast. Well, actually, planet-wide here today.
Exactly.
Tom Hayden has dropped by. He's also one of the speakers here at the Praxis Peace Conference. His new book, Ending the War in Iraq, a professor at Pittsburgh. Pitzer?
Pitzer College.
College, thank you.
The Pitzkers are the wealthy people
yeah.
in Chicago.
That's right.
You know. You would know that.
Yes. And a former state senator in California, and you're on your way to speak at a big anti-war rally in Rome, Italy.
Correct. There's actually two because the left is divided. I don't know which one I'm speaking at.
So one or the other. Either the left or the other left.
That's right.
This should be fun. You gave a talk yesterday, Tom, that I really provoked a lot of thought on my mind. First of all, are your headphones working okay?
They feel good.
Yeah, okay, fine. You were talking about the intersection of the power structure, what you referred to as the Machiavellians, and the existing power structure, and the movement, and how movements galvanize around single issues like wars, and that point of intersection creates the beginning of reform. And first of all, can you riff on that for just a second, just for our listeners who, you know, I mean, I just threw that out there, and there's a lot of information embedded in that. So just a
well, it's a book that remains to be written, but I'm trying to make sense of my own experience. I'm, on the one hand, a longtime activist, on the other hand, I'm a sociologist and a writer. And it goes like this, that I think social movements don't get the credit they deserve for the things that we have, like vacations.
Hmm. Which came out of the union movement.
Exactly. Or the expansion of the franchise, or the environmental protections that we have. So I've been involved in these social movements, and as they succeed, they become caught up in institutions, and they do achieve real reform. Some on the left say the reforms are meaningless, but they're real in the sense that people really want these changes, and the establishment is at very averse to giving them for a very long time. It took at least 100 years of struggle for women to get the right to vote, for example. So I call it movements intersecting and battling with Machiavellians, and it's an M model. Your movement begins at the margins, cultural or otherwise, economic. You go through a community of meaning phase where it's just a little band of people who sustain each other spiritually and morally and culturally.
And to a certain extent define themselves by the issue.
Yes, or get defined that way.
Yeah.
They gain their identity that way, you'd say. Eventually they hit the mainstream, 10, 20, 30% support. And if their core issue represents something that comes from a long tradition, it's a next step forward, many other people can sympathize, if not join, they eventually become a majority. Mm-hmm. And when they become a majority, they usually achieve the original reform. But by that point, the movement has divided into people who want more than the original reform and are skeptical, and people who just want the original reform, like get the troops out of Iraq.
Right.
The Machiavellians also divide in a parallel way. There are the Machiavellians like the Baker-Hamilton Report group that want a partial or phased withdrawal from Iraq because they think it's causing too much chaos, polarization. The cost is too high. They're worried about Republican fortunes in the next election and so on. And you get more extreme Machiavellians like Cheney and the neocons who want to go beyond the present arrangement.
They want to transform the world.
They want to take it to another level. They're kind of the parallel with the radicals from the movement.
Yeah.
And the peculiar thing about American society is that we come very close to the brink over and over, Civil War, 1960s, 1930s. But usually there's a massive reform that satisfies most people but leaves a lot of disappointment on both sides, the movement and the Machiavellians, mm-hmm. and we move on. And I think that where we are with Iraq is the movement started at an extreme margin because after 9/11, anybody that criticized the government was in hell. They were in trouble.
Oh, Bill Murray got thrown off the air.
Exactly. For the media in particular.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it expanded so that by as early as 2003, you had the largest demonstrations ever. And then people say, well, where did it go? Well, when you expand well beyond the streets, you go into the institutions and you reappear as the Howard Dean campaign of 03,
yeah.
who was kind of the Eugene McCarthy. You reappear within the John Kerry campaign. But other things happen that break the inside-outside borders, like the Michael Moore movie, Fahrenheit 9/11,
right.
or Move On. People don't realize, I didn't until I researched this book, that Move On members raised $180 million in the 03-04 campaign cycle,
mm-hmm.
presidential politics. When has a peace group ever become a player, so to speak,
yeah.
in the politics of money? And then you saw the American people switch to viewing the war as a mistake faster than during Vietnam. This occurred in 04-05. And by 06, you had the phenomenon of the voters throwing out the Republicans who were dominating the Congress. And it was largely on the issue of Iraq. So here we are now with a great change going on. And some people think it isn't happening rapidly enough. I understand that. But the movement has reached a strong majority with respect to getting out of Iraq.
So by some definitions, it's no longer a movement. It's now
some
the Machiavellians.
Some people feel, oh, my God, we're being co-opted.
We've become the majority.
Yeah, and they have an identity crisis perhaps over yeah. that. But on the other hand, we have to get used to the dynamics of winning, and winning has its own contradictions and problems. But mm-hmm. I would say from the movement point of view, if you include the role of the voters, which you have to, the movement is winning, and the Machiavellians are considering their options. A partial pullout of Iraq would probably demobilize the movement, do you think?
Right.
Francis,
yeah.
you can everybody can answer.
Yeah. Well, and this is,
or they might want to escalate to Iran, which would intensify the movement.
Which is Cheney's thing, you know.
It may be Cheney's thing. I think they're more likely to realize that they have to fold on some level and go for the best deal they can, because they don't have the resources to start a war with Iran right now.
Now, you made the point yesterday that this was the first time in the history of the Republic, in the history of the United States, that the people had voted against a war that was ongoing.
Yes, it's arguable. I mean, they voted for Nixon, who promised a false peace, but
yeah.
generally, neither party wanted this last election to be about Iraq until the very end. The Democrats turned a bit, and people voted a gerrymandered Congress out of its majority Republican
status.
Which
is inconceivable.
As a longtime politician, I can tell you it's not supposed to ever happen. You're
right.
supposed to assign these safe seats. So this meant the movement impulse had spread to Republicans beyond Democrats and independents, because how else did Richard Pombo out there in California get beaten? He had to lose Republican support. And I think Bush may not be running for re-election, we know that, but the Republicans who are running in 08 are pressuring Bush to do something.
Right.
And he, of course, will make his own choice, but I think the big Machiavellian would be James Baker, and he will be
sure.
stepping in and saying,
who is really representing the old Bush dynasty.
Yes, and oil.
Yeah. Which is the old Bush dynasty.
That's right. Let's
But the thing that troubled me, or I guess that provoked the question I've been looking forward to this moment to ask you, is your notion that movements, when they achieve their goals, not only dissolve, but they also evoke counter movements among the Machiavellians, who then become committed to destroying the goals of the movement, and the movement has now just dispersed itself. And to the extent that, for example, listeners of this program, people who identify themselves as progressives, you know, the quote left in America, the Democratic Party for that matter, to the extent that they may accomplish their goal in the next little bit, in the next, you know, 18 months. And I think, frankly, the Republicans are going to do it for them and take credit for it. To that extent,
that would be in keeping with the model.
Right. To that extent, will that be the end of the movement? And if so, what's going to replace it?
Not the end of the movement in a general sense, but movement's peak, and the anti-war movement is peaking and may intensify. but it would be the most natural thing, in my experience, if the troops are pulled back, mm-hmm. however imperfect the whole settlement goes, when the troops come back, the movement activists will demobilize and divide.
Right.
And then the politics of blame will begin. Some of the Machiavellians will try to come back and say, I told you so, you know, this went wrong in Iraq,
right.
and it was really, the liberals' fault,
right.
and so on. We're already getting to that point. So the reform is the end of the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
And it's just the result of that is some demobilization,
yeah.
but people have always found reasons to go on and build new.
Well, that's
movements.
The thing, and that's you know what's I'd
your
like
audience
look,
is secure, Tom Hartman.
Well, I'd like to look at the crystal ball and I'll also get Francis's thoughts also and what the next movement might be. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Crucifix ain't no baseball bat. Tell me what kind of God is that? Ain't nothing more godless than a war. So what are we fighting for?
That's a very good question. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio. We're broadcasting live from Dubrovnik, Croatia. In fact, we're using the studios of Radio Dubrovnik, whose transmitter, the tower, which we can see on the hill right across from us, was the first thing bombed in 1991 when they came. It's a statement of the power of the media. And here in the studio with me, some of the attendees or some of the speakers at the conference, the Praxis Peace Conference, Tom Hayden, Francis Moore LePay, David Corton, Swami Beyondananda is with us, Steve Behrman, and Steve is also in our chat room right at the moment and hanging out with folks and channeling Bullwinkle for the chat room. and Sue Nethercutt, who normally runs our chat room, Sue Nethercutt, she is here with us as well and waves and says hi. We have a limited number of microphones. First of all, we were having this conversation about what happens with movements and where they go and how they go and where they end. And Francis and David, you both had some thoughts on what Tom was saying. And let's just engage this conversation a little bit farther. What is next?
Well, my worry is that people, by focusing on the Machiavellians, the bad
the power
guys,
structure,
the power structure, that we don't enable people to actually see the system that has created this perpetual war, so-called war on terror, that we don't enable people to see the concentrate, the systematic, the inevitable, inexorable concentration of wealth that leads to rule by private power, so that we end up what FDR and many have warned us against in 1938. Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, the liberty of democracy is not safe if we tolerate the growth of private power to the point that it is stronger than the democratic state itself. That, in its essence, is fascism. And so we have to help people, I think, see that this perpetual war, so-called war on terror, is really an outgrowth, a symptom of this deeper causal pattern that is inexorably concentrating wealth and lead to control of the public sphere by private wealth.
Apropos of that, I'm not sure if any of you saw the Democratic debate on Monday night, Sunday night, whatever it was. I stayed up until 3 o'clock in the morning to watch it here local time. Excuse me. And one of the questions was of John Edwards. And they said, John Edwards, you have said that the war on terror is a bumper sticker. It's a bumper sticker slogan. It's not a real thing. And several of the Democratic candidates went off after him saying, no, it's not a bumper sticker slogan. But, you know, Tom Hayden, your thoughts on this?
Well, I don't disagree with Francis. I just have a more subjective view of it. I'm trying to tell a story. There's activists and there's Machiavellians. Machiavellians are the technicians of power, and power is about corporations, government, religion, the military, the media. So there are these activators, and I think it's just a way of telling the story of social change. That's all. I don't disagree.
Mm-hmm.
On there are some Machiavellians who are actually quite incredible, you know, like FDR, who had a disability and who was in the midst of a depression and a lot of radical movements, he seemed to grow on the job, and he accomplished some things in tandem with the movement, under the pressure of the movement.
Sure. He was originally elected as a basically kind of Hillary Clinton conservative.
Yeah. John Kennedy, the change as he encountered the lies of the CIA, the rise of the civil rights movement, the dangers inherent in the Cuban Missile Crisis. As a Machiavellian, he grew, seeking, he began just before he was killed talking about an alternative to the Cold War. Lincoln, moderate politician, but in the interaction of war, in the cauldron of war and the pressure of Douglas and others, Lincoln went further than I think Lincoln expected himself to. So,
well, let me
we have those
more.
Moments, but they're in America every few decades. I don't know if there's such a movement, a moment at hand. I would think if Bush were to go really mad and escalate into Iran, do something that's like way beyond the limits of his resources, I think the reaction would be so intense around the world that you would have a 60s moment or a 30s moment. I don't know where it would go.
I'm curious, Tom, if Tom Hayden, if in 1972 Nixon came back from negotiations with, it wasn't Khrushchev at the time, whoever was the leader of mm-hmm. the Soviet Union. And in part, I mean, this was something that Kissinger engineered, but he came back and he said, we have this glasnost thing or perestroika or whatever it was, the, mm-hmm. the phrase at the time. And he declared a famous speech he gave in 72 where he declared the end of fear, the end of terror. America no longer needs to live in fear. And within 6 months, the Committee for the Present Danger had been formed or had been reformed, mm-hmm. and Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney became active in that, and they started running television ads and all this sort of thing, and then within a year and a half, Nixon's out on his butt and Gerry Ford is in there, and he puts, you know, Rumsfeld and Cheney in as his Secretary of Defense and his Chief of Staff, and the Committee for the Present Danger, and Wolfowitz starts Plan B, and they come out with this whole idea that the Soviets actually have submarines that are so secret we can't even detect them, and the CIA says, no, they're not there, and Rumsfeld says, see, I told you so. Was that one of those moments?
He's a pretty significant Machiavellian, but they have their moments, but the movements are never defeated. I mean, what happened to all those people lately? What's happened to Rumsfeld, and what's happened to Wolfowitz, and what's happened to Libby is what happens when they exceed any conceivable mandate.
Would you argue that they're a movement, or that they're the Machiavellis, or both? That they're a movement within the Machiavellis?
No, the Machiavellians are always debating what kind of power they want. They want white power. They want multiracial power. They want more equality for women. They divide. Hmm. But I'd say, look at the G8 and these young people who are demonstrating right here in Europe, and you have the Machiavellians trying to hold on to their version of the world order.
Yeah.
Which you guys were talking about earlier.
Let's get into that a little more.
And the movement is trying to stop it.
Yeah.
We're right in the middle of this.
We'll get into that more in the next hour, right after the news at the top of the hour. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from Dubrovnik, Croatia, from the studios of Radio Dubrovnik. Boy, the power of the media here, as I said, I mentioned before, that this was their transmitter, one of the first things bombed in 91. This city under siege for about a year, no electricity, no water, no food for several months. I mean, the stories that we're hearing are pretty amazing. Tom Hayden in the studio with me, and Francis Moore LePay, David Corton, Swami Vyananda is with us here. Steve Behrman, also Steve is hanging out in our chat room as well, and channeling Bullwinkle right directly to you in the chat, which you can get to by going to airamerica.com or tomhartman.com and click on the link to the live chat room. We were just talking about Tom Hayden, your model of the Machiavellis, the existing power structure, and the movement, and how movements coalesce around single issues, and then when those issues are achieved, the movements disintegrate and counter movements form, and all this fascinating political theory. And at this moment, and this is what you brought it to, just as at the end of the last segment, the last hour, is that we're seeing this played out right now in Europe. This is the G8 meeting. And I'd like to hear from each one of the three of you your take on what's going on with the G8. What is happening? What are we seeing? Well, Tom, you take the first shot at it. You open it.
I think there's a social movement that's participatory in nature that is challenging the whole post-Cold War system that's embodied by the Machiavellians of the G8. And where this breaks down into issues that people can do something about, I think there's two at least, maybe four. But one is, what's the United States really going to do about trade? Is it going to impose and fail to impose a neoliberal agenda on the world? You know,
the so-called free trade agenda.
Ransack these economies, come into areas like Croatia and have the American rich buy up all the property and so on. And the second one, of course, is global warming or the environmental crisis, including the crisis of the global south, where you see, as Francis was saying at the break, there's strong majorities that want action. The movements have arrived, and what compromises are being considered, and whether these compromises are even worthy of the name compromise, some are. Is the next issue, and until these issues are settled, I don't think the movement will decline. I think after Iraq, if Iraq ends, the movement will really concentrate on these kinds of issues. And you're seeing, no matter what they do, 20,000 police in Germany, helicopters, all the rest of it, we see here on European CNN thousands of people with the backpacks marching across the fields of Germany, blocking the roads, making it impossible for the Machiavellians to have their party.
This is the story here. When we were walking over here, David and Francis and I stopped at a newsstand, and they didn't have any English language papers, but they had a couple of German language papers, and my German is bad enough that I can sort more or less tell what's going on. And the lead story on the main German newspaper was about the blowback. It was about the protesters. It wasn't about what was going on at the G8. It was about what was going on against the G8. And what we've been seeing in BBC and CNN International in our hotel rooms has been about the blowback. I'm curious, Francis Moore LePay, what do you see emerging as the movement, with or parallel to or different from the Iraq movement, as that begins to fade and other things come to the fore?
Well, what I'm excited about here in watching what is happening in Europe is I think that far from ideal, of course, but there is less control by private wealth of the political system. The social movements are having more effect here, as we see in the kind of legislation that is creating sustainable agriculture and introducing very, very powerfully renewable energy in a country like Germany. So it's happening here, and I think that's
here in Europe
in a way that is not in the United States, despite the public opinion wanting it now in the United States.
Right.
And so I take great heart in this evidence that we can see what can happen when there is a greater opening for the voices of citizens as we see here. So when I think of, you know, what do I want to help manifest is not an issue movement, but a democracy movement, what I call living democracy, and David calls the Earth Community, and others call Another World is Possible, that we can imagine, and this is what we all have to be envisioning, a society that is really values-driven, in which the market actually works because it is a context that is set within a values context and where wealth is continually redistributed so that we can all participate in the market. That's a living democracy, and that's, I think, beyond any particular issue.
In a way, it's reclaiming. Now, my frame on that is it's reclaiming the original values of this country, even though they were poorly acted out and imperfectly executed. There were two periods of time in the history of the United States when we did not have family dynasties emerging. From the 1760s until the 1820s, there are no dynasties left from that period of time. There essentially were no rich, truly rich people in the United States during that time. Dynasties began to emerge after the Civil War and carried right up until the early 1930s. And then from the mid-1930s through the 1980s, there was, or the early 1980s, again, we didn't have new family dynasties emerging. You could argue there were some corporate dynasties emerging, but even that was under 90% top marginal tax rates. So there were these two periods of time where America was essentially not dynastic, where it was going back to its roots. And arguably, you could throw Teddy Roosevelt, you could throw, you know, 1901 to 1918 in there as well, although it was kind of frozen. It was static. You know, the Rockefellers and the Morgans and they had all established their dynasties, and you had the robber baron era. But first of all, does that make sense, and does that tie into the vision that you're talking about?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I love the way you put it. And I sense the possibility now, and that's what I feel, that people can begin to see what it could mean to remove this illusion of what I call thin democracy, because it is so frail and so frail and so weak and so thin, this idea of simply democracy means elections plus a one-rule economy, that is highest return to money, as David puts it. So we end up then with a system that is controlled not by the citizenry, but by a handful of private interests. And that isn't going to work for us, and it cannot rescue the planet, which I feel most people recognize today, that the planet is against the ropes and they want to do something. And so we've got to transcend individual issues to this fundamental question of reclaiming democracy itself.
So how do you see that in the interaction with what the G8, what's going on right now in Germany as we speak?
Well, I'm hoping that Americans see the possibility that there are these standards set in terms of a goal, that no longer is the rest of the world going to tolerate the United States contributing a quarter of all the emissions in the world, and that this is not going to be tolerated anymore. And I'm hoping that this gives courage to people in the United States.
But Merkel, I mean, we just heard the news at the top of the hour. Andrea Merkel is saying we're going to cut emissions by 2050. And, you know, I'm wondering to what extent is this real reform versus cosmetic? You know, to what extent is this simply the Machiavellians, use Tom's term?
43 years.
Yeah, yeah. To what extent are they simply rearranging the deck chairs, you know, or whatever lousy metaphor you want to use, as opposed to actually creating transformation?
But isn't the real issue how do we remove that private control over the commons? And therefore, that means getting money out of the political system. And that's why this new national effort of just $6, this is a national campaign now in the States. It's happening, we mentioned earlier, Arizona, Maine, with clean elections. So I want to help us all see that we've got to get dollars out of control of our political system so that we can express our values through our political system.
It always seems to come back to public financing of elections.
This is a key part. Absolutely. And now I think this is the best kept secret in America, that in a couple of states it's working. It's going to start in 2008 in Connecticut. They've passed a very important reform there as well. So this is what, you know, I think people have become so cynical because they don't hear the story of how this is working.
Yeah, but and you see it is working in a few places in America.
And more people are voting in these states. Teachers are running for office. Waitresses are running for office and winning.
Right. To what extent, then, the question, to take it back to Tom's model, and David, I'd like to get your thoughts on this when we come back from the break, is to what extent is that movement then going to become co-opted by the Machiavellians and then become a counter-movement? You know, where are we going with that? And then we'll be taking your calls as well. 1-866-303-2270. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Sailing away on the
It's magic being here in Dubrovnik, Croatia, at Radio Dubrovnik, broadcasting live on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Frances Moore LePay, her books Democracy's Edge and Getting a Grip, her new book coming out. David Corton, The Great Turning, and When Corporations Rule the World. Tom Hayden, Ending the War in Iraq, and Swami Beyond Ananda, and Steve Behrman, and the author of
Swami for President, A Seven-Step Plan to Heal the Body Politic and Cure Electile Dysfunction.
Ah, yes. A fine thing. David Corton, I wanted to get your take. We've been talking here about the G8. What's going on with the G8? And you know, pulling back the curtain, who is that man behind the curtain? What do you see?
Well, I think we've got to put this whole thing in a little deeper perspective. And part of the excitement of my life has been participating in and seeing the whole evolution of what we call global civil society as a new dynamic political force.
Mm-hmm.
And at least in my experience, this began to come together in 1992 at the Rio Earth Summit, which was the first time that you had very large numbers of ordinary citizens from every country, religion, linguistic group, and so forth, meeting together to share their vision of the world that can be, the new world.
A movement emerging.
Now, that was the time that the Internet was really kicking in, and we began to get truly costless, instantaneous communication among ordinary people all around the world. Now, that began to coalesce originally around these issues of free trade, global corporate takeover, which is in many ways a democracy issue at its heart, but it was focused around the particular trade agreements kinds of issues and the rewriting rules of global commerce.
Right.
That was gaining enormous momentum and, of course, creating these massive demonstrations every time there was a WTO meeting or there was a meeting of G8 or any of those kinds of get-togethers of the elite to decide how they're going to divide up the world's wealth. Now, Bush came in, we had 9/11. After 9/11, we had this crackdown, and we actually had the members of the plutocracy and the Bush administration saying, you know, it's not just about trade. This is about empire. It is about imposing America's will on the world by naked military force. Now, this began to re-engage the development of a larger framework within the movement. You know, the next set of expressions as Bush was pursuing his wars focused on the peace issue, although many of the demonstrators and the groups defined themselves as peace and justice.
Mm-hmm. So now, the movement began to morph.
In terms of a broadening agenda.
But peace and justice, I mean, that goes back to Emerson. I mean, Thoreau was talking about peace and justice.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a new idea, but it is, you know, got this enormous traction with growing millions of ordinary people all around the world who are mobilizing politically. But they're also organizing around all kinds of other positive initiatives to rebuild their local economies, rebuild community, exploring the relationship between spiritual awakening and the building of community. It is becoming a multi-issue force, which mm-hmm. is kind of the meta frame in which all this is taking place. And I think, you know, I think very much, as what Frankie was saying, that it's moving into becoming a living democracy movement. And that is about shifting, reframing the whole distribution of power in the world. Yeah. And within societies. So, you know, one of the immediate manifestations, of course, is, you know, the financial system, the concentrations of financial power, which is one of the powerful systems of creating this dominator system to undermining, gaining, you know, buying out democracy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which, of course, is all creating a rapidly growing awareness that what we have is not democracy. We could debate whether it's ever been a democracy, but mm-hmm. clearly it is now a plutocracy, a system of rule by people of wealth. And as people are waking up to that, these movements, this political energy, is really taking on the whole system of a hierarchical dominator structure. This is...
And you're very optimistic that this is a real movement and that this is actually...
Absolutely, and it's not going to go away.
Tom Hayden, as our resident kind of political analyst, I mean, you've been on the inside, you've been on the outside, you've been all around this thing. Do you think that this is cosmetic?
I think that there's a very large movement, as David has described it, that is inspired. It's inspirational. It has very generalized demands, but... Whether the hierarchical system of the Machiavellis will be overthrown is dependent on whether the current system, the G8 types, deliver on ending global poverty. Do you think they will?
No.
Deliver on ending environmental destruction. Do you think they will?
Not a chance.
Well, if they can't deliver, then that means there will be...
But that means the movement
a power
continues.
Shift of some. No, the movement will become about a power shift, not just about single issues. We'll see.
Right.
It's about withdrawing power from the system. A very wise friend of mine named Tom Hartman once talked about walking away from the king, and I think that's a concept that is right on target here.
All right. We'll continue the conversation and take your calls as well in just a minute. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
34 minutes past the hour, broadcasting live. It's actually 34 minutes past the hour of 8 p.m. here in Dubrovnik, Croatia. It's no doubt some different hour wherever you may be. Tom Hartman here, Francis Moore LePay, David Corton, Tom Hayden, Swami Beyondananda, also known as Steve Behrman, all of us collectively here in the group. And Steve in Mountain View, California. Welcome to the program. Hey, Steve.
Good morning, Tom. So, good morning here. I like what I heard on, I'm ready to pitch in. I want to know what can be done reasonably to become a viable candidate here on a local level here in California.
How do people get involved in politics at the local level? Well, Tom Hayden, you've been involved in politics, particularly in California. I assume you started at some sort of a local. Take a shot at it. Thanks, Steve.
I would like to see politics rest on local civil society and activists and people who don't even think of themselves as wanting to be elected, and school boards, city councils. That's where the decisions are made over what our children learn and what happens to the quality of our local life with zoning decisions and development. And I'll tell you another thing. That's where the politicians are groomed to go to Congress and often become creatures of those local franchises of big power structures. So they're already in training for becoming part of the system.
For better or for worse.
Yes. So interventions at that local level, I think, are more important than...
This is what the Republicans did back in the 60s
and
70s.
That's true, actually.
It was this, let's take the thing over from within. Francis Moore LePay, this is one of your hot issues, is this whole idea of local politics and people being empowered and getting involved. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I just wanted to reinforce what Tom just said. One of my favorite examples of what we can each do is encourage what I call apprentice citizenship in schools, where kids are not just doing service, which is now very common, service learning, community service, but actually engaged in problem solving in their communities. Group in Maine called the Kids Consortium. And that genie you cannot put back in the bottle once children have that sense of power, that they are actually decision makers. So I just second what Tom is saying. But starting with whatever you, the caller, your passions are, I'm so excited, as David was talking earlier, about this civil society that is growing, and we can access, find out about pieces of it through the Internet. No matter what our passions are, we can find that entry point to begin to shift the power by taking more of it ourselves and becoming problem solvers ourselves, whatever your passion is.
Great point.
I want to emphasize it's not not just about running for office, conventional politics. It is about taking back our power.
David Corton.
And a lot of the some of the most exciting action that I see going on, particularly around the United States, is taking back local economies and rebuilding local economies based on local independent enterprises. Now, this also then gets you into all of the local political debates about who's going to get incentives. You bring in box stores. How do you favor your local entrepreneurs that are living by community values? It's a whole process of taking back power, beginning to then shift the whole political dynamic so that it becomes much more possible to put into office local candidates that are not supporting the local developers but are actually really concerned about how do you meet the interests, take care of the interests of everyone and rebuild community.
Swami, this goes beyond curing electoral dysfunction.
Oh yes, this is about being right there at the grassroots and retaking America from the grassroots up, mm-hmm. like a good uprising.
A good uprising, indeed. Yeah, and we're all wising up.
Waking up and wising up.
There you go.
Could I jump in on what David just said? You know, we hear the word co-op or cooperative, and we often think quaint and marginal, but actually more people are members of co-ops in the world than own shares in publicly traded companies.
Yeah, I heard that last night. I was astounded.
And I have been so struck. Say, I have to tell a story about myself. In the late 80s, I was sitting on a hard pew in a church in western Wisconsin, and these dairy farmers were telling about how they were going to create an organic dairy co-op, and I thought, how sweet. They might help a few farmers in western Wisconsin. This is now a democratically run, worker-owned dairy cooperative that I can buy the products of in Boston. This is Organic Valley, now 1,000 farm families returning wealth back to rural communities, all organized, kept in a democratic structure. They confer over the telephone every month over policy. So we've got to drop this notion that there's only one way to organize a market, and that is by control by outside capital. And I second what David was saying about local living economies that are emerging. There are now, I believe, 50 cities, something like that, that are involved in the local living economy.
Yeah, it's 52 now. It's
52 cities.
It's doubling every year.
And some of them, well, I just saw a wonderful presentation from Powell, Wyoming, where in my book, Democracy's Edge, I tell this story too, where a local community had lost its department store. And so instead of welcoming in Walmart, they sold shares. And it's now a community-owned department store that is booming, and other small towns are coming in to look at this model. And
yeah, we saw this with our health food store in Montpelier, Vermont, and it was really cool, and it really worked. And at the end of the year, you'd get a $25 check or your share, you know, and the prices were great. And you could, if you worked in the store, you could get discount prices and things. But, you know, Tom Hayden, to what extent do you see this, the possible transformation of capitalism in the context of democracy? And also, it looked like you wanted to say something in addition to... No, okay, go for it.
Well, I'm puzzled. I just always try to review my own experience, and war keeps coming up as the great obstacle to domestic reform. I'm uncomfortable with the implication that Iraq war is over or it's going to end anyway. Because we were talking earlier about how there seems to be war after war after war. And I can't imagine building a good society, a commonwealth with resources in America while having a war every 5 years. So I think the issue of what we used to call imperialism has to be incorporated into discussions of domestic reform. My experience, I was knocking on doors in Newark and the Vietnam War started, and that was the end of the war on poverty.
Mm.
And I wasn't looking for the Iraq War, it's looking for us. It got in the way of this movement that Mr. Corton was talking about, the anti-globalization, the global justice movement was expanding, and suddenly you had 9/11. Then you had the framework of the war on terror, and then the first lab for the war on terror became Afghanistan, mm-hmm. then Iraq, and only through the failure of that avenue will we successfully get to complete any domestic aspirations we have, I'm afraid. That's my experience.
That's what Eisenhower said.
But I think
yes, exactly, he did.
What's exciting about what's happening is I think that more and more of the groups involved in these activities are seeing each of their contributions within that larger framework. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, Frankie was referring to these 52 local living economies. I just came here from Berkeley from the conference of the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, which is organizing these initiatives all across the country. Now, I was one of the opening speakers and putting that whole effort into the context of this is an effort to bring an end to empire and to build living communities that bring us as human beings back into a cooperative relationship in communities of people and communities connected to our place on Earth. And so the whole issue of imperial nations, of war, it's all part of that initiative. And that's where I think this, the recognizing that what we're experiencing in the United States, it's not one war. I mean, part of the way Machiavelli control us is by getting us to think one war at a time, or to separate all these economic issues from the political issues, from the military issues. And by coming to see that it's really one issue, and it is the transformation of the relationships of power, human relationships with one another and Earth, is a huge step toward actually solving the problem at its deeper root.
And money being an instrument of power.
Money, absolutely.
Money represents human energy.
That's a whole other subject, but one of the most important things that we need to bring into the consciousness is a deeper awareness of how the money system works. Now, you know, money is obviously a very useful institution in terms of a medium of exchange, but it has become so distorted, so out of control as a system of power. It is a naked system of power. And part of the enormous distortion is recognizing how the global financial system, with the lending of the banks and the hedge funds and the speculation, the inflation of financial and real estate assets, is creating money out of nothing at a mind-boggling rate without creating any real value. But is putting more and more of these accounting chits in the hands of a very small group of financiers. I mean, one of the most stunning statistics about the distortions, there was recently articles in Forbes magazine and the New York Times about the income last year of the heads, the highest paid hedge fund managers. The highest paid, the highest compensated, received $1.7 billion in compensation last year. Forbes magazine. This is one guy in 1 year.
Now that, and all he's doing is handling other people's money.
Boy, yeah. Talk about hedgehogs.
Yes. Well, I mean, this is $1,700 million. And it's all in return for running a colossal gambling casino, which threatens to destabilize the whole global financial system.
Maybe that should be our tax system, where we become the house.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good point, Steve. 45 minutes past the hour.
Just a mile off the road. Take it in, take it with you when you go. Who says you can't go home? Who says you can't go back? Been all around the world, and as a matter of fact.
Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio, 9.5 minutes before the hour. We're sitting here in the studio in Dubrovnik, Croatia, as down the road the G8 is moving along, shall we say, in northern Germany. And Francis Moore-Lepay with me, Swami Biyanananda, David Corton, Tom Hayden just headed out to grab a bite and to eat, and Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us from New York City. Victoria, you're at the United Nations.
Yes, we're at the United Nations today. It's Talk Radio Day at the United Nations with Talkers Magazine and the Talk Radio News Service. And we have a guest for you. We have UNESCO's representative to the United Nations, Ellen Marie Gosselin, who I have to say, when she heard you were in Croatia, she got very excited. So I'm going to put her on the air with you right now.
Well, thank you, Victoria.
Hi, Tom.
Hello, Helen Marie Gosseling. It's great to have you with us. The United Nations Education Social Scientific Organization. What is UNESCO up to these days?
Well, actually, as you're in Croatia, maybe I could talk to you about trying to safeguard the cultural heritage of Croatia and the 190 other member states that UNESCO is serving. That is one part of our mission, to preserve culture, to promote culture. And as I don't know, where are you in Croatia precisely?
We're in Dubrovnik. We're actually broadcasting today from the studios of Radio Dubrovnik, and in just two blocks from the old city.
Well, the line is not so clear. Well, for example, in Croatia, UNESCO has been helping with, first of all, in trying to prevent during the conflict Dubrovnik from being bombarded. As you may know, Dubrovnik is a World Heritage City, or part of the old Dubrovnik, and its fortification. And we have been actively involved afterwards to reconstruct Dubrovnik. But that is one of the things we do. Now, UNESCO also stands for education, and essentially we are the education arm of the United Nations system. That means that we're advising government and helping countries to develop or improve their educational policies, to look at issues such as teacher training, for example, but also something that is probably very universal and also much talked about in the United States even, and that's the issue of quality of education. That's a major issue that UNESCO is involved in right now as a technical agency, with providing technical expertise in the UN family.
I'm curious, Helen Marie Gosseling, the representative of UNESCO to the United Nations. One of the things that we're hearing here in Croatia is that the transformation from a state-run economy to a privately owned economy, from the so-called communist system to the so-called capitalist system, was very, very clumsily and poorly handled, both in the Soviet Union and Croatia, as probably the two worst examples of how it was handled. To what extent is the UN and or UNESCO involved in issues of culture and education and for that matter social justice in the context or framework of economic systems?
I'm sorry, the line was not excellent, but if I understand well your question, what is UNESCO doing in this globalized world when it comes to education and culture? Was that your reason?
That's a great way to say it, yes.
Okay. Well, you know, as we talk about globalization, of course, there have been many critics of globalization. We at UNESCO have been looking also at the positive side of globalization. What I mean to say for that is, if you take education nowadays, with the formidable access to new technologies that are available, it doesn't mean that everybody who should have access does. But what UNESCO is doing, along with many other partners in the UN system and non-governmental organizations, and increasingly the private sector as well, we are working to try to make education, first of all, accessible to the greatest number of people. Illiteracy is still a huge problem in the world today, as you may know. There's still some over 800 million people in the world, adults, who are illiterate. So we are trying to not only work on the educational policies, but we're also trying to look at the issue of access. Now, access is one thing, quality is another one. And an area, and that is valid for a country like Croatia, as it is valid for many other countries, including newly industrialized and newly developed countries, is the issue of the content of education or the curriculum. A part of UNESCO's work, which is lesser known maybe, is, for example, trying to help developing or retraining teachers, looking at educational curriculum, materials, so that we can improve the quality. Is the education we give our kids today, whether we are in Canada, my home country, or in Croatia, or indeed in South Africa, is adapted to today's world, giving the kind of knowledge and skills and competence that people need? So these are some of the great issues that we are involved in today.
Well, that's marvelous. Helen Marie Gosseling of the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural, or Social and Scientific Organization. Thanks so much for being with us, Helen.
Thanks so much, Tom, and do enjoy Croatia. This is a great country. Thank you
so much. Oh, it is. Yeah, we are. Thank you very much. Great speaking with you. Bye now. Thoughts on all this?
Well, you know, globalization is one thing. I think what we've been talking about is gobblization.
Gobblization. Gobbling up the resources.
We have to stop those turkeys.
Yes.
Yeah,
David Corton.
I think you got a very good point there, Swami. You know, those of us that are involved in what's often referred to as the anti-globalization movement are not against globalization of people, power, and exchange of culture. Of course, what we're concerned about is globalization, the gobbling up of the world by global corporations. And I'm really disappointed that she seemed to totally miss the point that part of this corporate takeover is about the homogenization and destruction of local cultures.
Yeah, well, to some extent, she couldn't hear my question. So
yeah, that may be the maybe
I, 10 seconds here, Frankie.
I'm with you, and I prefer to call it pro-democracy movement rather than anti-globalization, and I love this conversation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is taking back the language.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Frances Moore LePay, her books Democracy's Edge, Getting a Grip, Tom Hayden, Ending the War in Iraq, David Corton, The Great Turning, and When Corporations Rule the World, and Swami Beyond Ananda with the Swami's... Go for it, Swami.
Swami for President, a 7-step plan to heal the body politic and cure electile dysfunction.
Peter B. Collins will be back tomorrow. I'll be back in the United States on Monday. We'll see you then. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.